Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Later on in this segment, we will hear from the DNR's John Pepin and J.R. Richardson as we discuss chronic wasting disease in deer. But first, from the Copper Country Vegans, here's Craig Tarvinen.
I could probably safely say that you're not going to convince me in the next 25 minutes to become a vegan, but it doesn't have to be. And for people that are listening, that doesn't have to be the point of this conversation. It's to understand, you know, what being a vegan is all about. Choices that would lead, you know, what would lead people to make that choice. So educational, really. And that's, I'm interested in finding out. So let's start with, people may have different definitions of what a vegan is and sometimes confused with what a vegetarian is. So can you clarify that for us?
Well, a vegetarian is different from vegan in the sense that, okay, they both have decided not to eat meat products, meat or animal products. But the vegetarian, they continue to drink milk products, eat eggs, eat honey, those types of things. Whereas a vegan does not eat those.
I once worked with a coworker who described herself as a sort of a in between, in that she just didn't, she wouldn't eat anything that had a face. And I said, well, then, you know, vegan was becoming more popular. This would be about 10 years ago.
Sure.
And I was like, well, that's not vegan. That's more the vegetarian.
That's more the vegetarian, correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Let me start with you. Your background. Have you always been into this type of eating?
No, I have not. Actually, this is a fairly new journey for me. I mean, this all started approximately 4 years ago when my son decided he was going to become vegetarian for, you know, moral reasons. And so... just around the house, we were eating less and less meat because we were supporting his lifestyle. And so it was, you know, maybe several months into that, I saw a video that that he wanted me to see. And they were talking about the health implications of eating meat, meat and dairy products. And one of the studies that they pointed out, or one of the things they pointed out, was during World War II in Norway, you know, it was occupied by the Germans, and they showed that the instances of heart disease and stroke plummeted during the German occupation years for the fact that all of the meat, all of the animals were kind of commandeered to support the troops. And so, you know, the local inhabitants, you know, they were forced into kind of a plant-based diet. And, you know, just the instances of heart disease and stroke plummeted. And then once the war was over, you can slowly see those creep back up. And so it was at that point that, you know, I wasn't eating much meat anyway. I'm like, you know, I'm going to cut it out. And so that was kind of the first step of my journey. And so at that point, I was vegetarian. And then it's interesting, once you live that lifestyle for a while, your justifications for eating meat kind of start to fall away, and you start to get more in line with kind of the moral aspects of it, you know, to really consider, you know, what is it that's happening with these animals. And so that's, you know, about 2 years ago, I made the decision that, okay, I'm going to go all the way. I'm going to go vegan.
So prior to this, you were, you know, a regular old carnivore, grabbing a Burger King burger every now and then.
Yeah, I was the carnivore's carnivore. I mean, I took great pride in eating a 16-ounce steak, you know. I mean, I was definitely raised meat and potatoes, you know, and that's the way I ate all my life up until now.
What changes were you feeling in your body, both either positive or negative, as far as withdrawal-wise, when you started changing your diet?
I'm also a little bit of an athlete, and I did notice that, you know, things became easier as I was removing myself from the meat and finally the dairy. The dairy was a big one. I could really notice it in my body when, you know, once I got off of the meat. And, you know, there is an initial period of, you know, some amount of cravings, and, you know, it's all a question of how you treat this. Are you treating this as a diet, or are you treating this as a life commitment, you know? And so when you treat it as a diet, you know, you kind of have these cravings, or it's kind of the mentality of, I can't have this, I can't have that type of thing, and it makes it kind of worse. And so once I committed to it, then that kind of went away. And at this point, I don't crave it at all.
Now, especially with getting rid of dairy, see, most people can understand what meat is, but dairy is in, like, everything. It's in so many things. I mean, when you started thinking, okay, not going to have milk with your cereal, but then you're also not going to have cheese, sour cream, yogurt, a number of different things.
Right. And that was a difficult one for me. The big one was ice cream. I mean, I absolutely love ice cream. But once that commitment was there, it became relatively easy. As of now, they've come out with a number of alternatives to dairy ice cream. You know, there's the ones that have been out there for a while. You know, they've got soy and coconut and other substitutes. But Ben & Jerry's has come out with, I believe it's an almond-based alternative that I couldn't tell the difference, honestly. So it becomes easier and easier to do this.
Did you have to do anything differently as far as supplementing what you were losing with the meat, some of the vitamins and that we get from meat?
Becoming vegetarian or vegan has gotten easier over the years, just because there's a number of companies that have seen the number of people that are going this direction and seeing the opportunity to produce these, what I would call alternative types of foods. So for example, there is, alternative beef crumbles, there's alternative chicken strips, there's alternative sausages, hot dogs, that type of thing. And so, when you first have them, depending on the product, some are closer than others to, what we would consider the real thing. Once you get used to these, I mean, you're not giving up anything. You know, you're having a lot of the same foods that you had before. And in my mind, I kind of consider them cheater foods because, the people that are, really seasoned vegans, they've been doing it long enough that, they've got this familiarity with the various foods that are available that they don't need these cheater foods. But for me, I mean, I'm used to a certain regimen of, recipes or types of foods that I eat. And so transitioning is having these alternatives has made that transition easier.
We're going to talk more about what a daily diet might look like for a vegan in a little bit, but I wanted to stay on the track as far as what reasons people may have to choosing the vegan lifestyle. Now, yours had to deal with, first you were supporting your son, and then there were a lot of moral reasons that led you to make this commitment. What are some other reasons that other people may have?
I think the primary one, and that's the one that started me down this road, is the health implications. There have been, lots of studies done and definite links to heart disease, cancer, diabetes. So, there's a number of films that talk specifically to that. And, they have numerous stories of people who, they're facing heart disease, they're facing, they're in danger of heart attacks, and switching their diets and having, having their symptoms regress or even disappear completely. I mean, I've heard of people who are diabetic who, by changes in their diet, turn that around completely. So, to me, that's, the primary reason I started down this road.
You perhaps have heard the idiom about seeing how the sausage is made, and that's because it's quite literally a belief that if a lot of people knew how sausage was made, there'd be fewer people eating it. And I know that a lot of those videos of of how the meat actually ends up at our grocery stores can be pretty graphic, and they're pretty effective for convincing a lot of people, as one was for you, as you were mentioned earlier, and being a motivator for people to choose, that they would rather not eat that product.
Right, exactly. And I think I've heard the similar sayings, that if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everybody would be vegan. Yeah, for me, it's the consideration is I've got options. With the way that I eat now, nothing has to die, And I mean, I guess I've always said that if push come to shove and I was, stranded in the wilderness or whatever, my choices might be very different. But as it stands today, I have options. And so I choose to eat a diet that does not include animal products.
What about spiritualism? Is that sometimes a motivator for people to, make this choice? you know, for whatever religious beliefs they may have, and they may find that this is more of a pure lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that, and I mean, you know, somebody pointed out to me once, I'm trying to recall, that, you know, if you look in the Bible, that initially men did not eat animals. You know, animals were, you know, kind of in the garden with, you know, with Adam, and it was only after they got, you know, ejected from the garden that men started to eat animals. And so, you know, a lot of vegans, what they're striving for is to be more like people were before they were, you know, removed from the garden.
Okay. And naturalistic religions too may follow along with that, that place the environment and certainly, you know, other animals as equal footing with humans, and that could be play a factor. I mean, in a certain percentage of the population is just trying to understand it. You know, that may not be everybody's motivation, but maybe some.
Right, exactly. I mean, people do this for you know, a variety of reasons. And, you know, with our group, that doesn't matter to us so much. I mean, you know, we've got some that do it for the health reasons, and they're hardcore. You know, they know all the numbers up and down. But then there's others who are definitely more on the moral path of this, you know. So, so yeah, so I mean, you know, we welcome everybody, you know, vegan or not. You know, we're just here to support, to educate. That's our goal.
What you have for breakfast today?
I had oatmeal today. That's a very common thing for me. It's just one of those things that I picked up, and I include a lot of times I'll put, you know, chia seeds in there for a little added nutrition. You know, that adds some protein to it. Very simple.
All right. And I use that to try to introduce our talk here about, you know, what does a, you know, a daily diet look like, or, you know, what are some of the choices that you have? First, I should ask, you know, is it more or less expensive, or really no difference in it, as far as when you go grocery shopping, to eat vegan as opposed to, you know, buying?
No, I don't think it's any more expensive. I mean, it's all a question of how much research you do and, you know, how much time you put into this. You know, like I said, there's a lot of these cheater foods out there, but them come at a cost. I mean, you pay kind of a premium price for these items. But if you did the research and you actually found, you know, the proper recipes and the right diet plan, you can do this very cheaply, very cheaply.
Is it all raw fruits and vegetables?
No, definitely not. And I mean, you can have a lot of the normal foods. I mean, for Christmas, I make a mean lasagna.
With no cheese?
With no cheese. But, you know, there are alternatives to that as well. And I mean, part of that is a cheese sauce that, you know, one of its primary ingredients is ground cashews. And I swear that sauce is better than any cheese sauce I ever had.
That's Craig Tarvinen from Copper Country Vegans. Now here's John Pepin and J.R. Richardson as we discuss chronic wasting disease in deer. What is chronic wasting disease and how does it affect deer?
Okay, I think the best way to answer that question, rather than getting into all the scientific jargon, is to have people think about mad cow disease. This is a transmissible disease that's caused by a mutated protein. So it's not a bacteria, it's not a virus, it's something that we can't kill. Temperatures of over 1100 degrees Fahrenheit will not destroy this thing. Pure bleach solutions will break it down by about 50%. When this mutated protein gets into the animal, it touches normal proteins and causes them to mutate. Situations in humans that would be relevant or analogous would be Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, and then what we call Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. Chronic wasting disease is 100% fatal. If a deer gets it, it will die from it. Unfortunately, it doesn't, you know, it's not one of those things that you can see right away, because the deer can get infected. They can live anywhere from a year and a half to 5 years after they're infected. The entire time, it takes about 42 days from date of infection till they start sloughing off these proteins and shedding them into the environment. So they're passing it on when they urinate, when they defecate, when they salivate. If somebody's got a sugar beet on the ground and an infected deer feeds on that sugar beet, another deer can come in and feed on it and pick up the disease. We know that it will persist in the environment for at least 16 years and most likely longer, because that's as long as the research has gone on. It can be incorporated into the grass plants. It can be passed on by two other animals when they eat the grass plant that picked it up from the soils. So you know, it's really an insidious disease that we're dealing with. And if we don't have a handle on it, it's going to change the face of the Upper Peninsula in terms of deer hunting.
When we started seeing reports of this here that we were running on our news, probably about 2 years ago, I think, is when we first started, you know, seeing things come. And, you know, I would post this stuff and we'd get questions like, well, what's CWD? And then, you know, people would look at it and then realize, oh, okay, well, it's not here. It's just downstate or it's a little west from us. And you know, our UP hunters, you know, weren't as worried about it. As it's starting to kind of grow and get closer, it really has one of the almost horror story type of plot lines of what could happen if it does, you know, if and when it does get into the Upper Peninsula and how it could devastate the deer herd population. And with everything else that is going on that is affecting our deer herd, the harsh winters that we've had, climate change, and then you had, you know, the CWD, if that was to get in here, could we look at something as dangerous as, you know, couple of decades from now and, you know, an extinct deer population in the UP?
If it gets here and we don't handle it properly, absolutely. They've done the studies out in Wyoming already where they're predicting extinction of a mule deer herd in 40 years and a white-tailed deer herd in 49 years because those populations are declining. The mule deer herd's declining at a rate of 20% per year. The white-tail's declining at a rate of 10% per year. So, and then if it gets into the environment, we never get rid of it. We can never get rid of it once it gets into the environment. And you start hearing about it 2 years ago because that's when it popped up 30 miles from our border in a penned-in facility down in Three Lakes, Wisconsin. Since then, it's popped up in another facility in Wisconsin about 40 miles from our border down in Gillett. So it's making its way here. We also know that crows and ravens can feed on contaminated meat, fly away, defecate, and spread the disease, as can coyotes and wolves. So, yeah, it could cause an extinction if we don't pay attention.
Does the disease only affect deer?
Right now, it's in the deer family, so it affects deer, elk, white-tailed deer, elk, mule deer, and moose. They have it in elk out west, they have it in moose out west, they have it in both of our deer species. Having said that, while we've never seen it in humans, there's research out there to show that there's no definitive barrier to keep it from getting into humans. We've not seen it, we don't think it's in humans, but there's no definitive barrier to stop that from happening.
You compared it to mad cow disease, and of course there was a scare about eating affected meat. Any concerns about, you know, for hunting deer, eating infected venison?
Yes. Just because we haven't seen it doesn't mean that it can't mutate and come into humans. We suspect that chronic wasting disease is a mutation from scrapies in sheep. Mad cow disease, it took, I don't know, 20 million exposures or something like that, but then 250 people died from mad cow disease. In addition, they've just done some analysis and they found that there's something like 200,000 people in the United Kingdom and 2 million people in the greater Europe that are latent carriers of mad cow disease. They haven't expressed the disease yet, but they're finding the prions in those people. So I won't eat it. If I've gotten infected deer, there's no way in the world I'm eating it.
But the CWD hasn't been found to be...
Right. It has not been found in people. We don't know that it ever will.
And we hope it never does, but you should be very, you know, be aware. And it's your body.
Yes. Yeah.
And as we stand today, it's not been detected at all in the Upper Peninsula.
Correct.
Okay. Does that mean it's not here?
No. We've got two scenarios across the landscape in North America. Places where we know there's chronic wasting disease and places that we can't prove that there isn't.
Okay. We're on a prevention campaign, and that's what we're trying to get through to everybody. You know, everything we can do, you know, if you look at statistically, you know, they say, I'm sure Terry believes this and John, that it's inevitable, but, you know, and everything we can do to stop that and that from being inevitable is what we're doing, and that's part of what we're on a campaign to do, is to make sure people understand the different pathways that it can get up here and communicate that to people so we can do everything in our power to keep it the heck out of here.
What efforts are being done right now in the areas where chronic wasting disease is seen in order to try to contain it and keep it there?
Well, for the most part, if you have for example, we've got chronic wasting disease in Lower Michigan. somebody shoots a deer in that area, they cannot take a whole carcass out of that area unless it's tested negative for the disease. Otherwise, all they can take out is the boned out meat, the skull cap, and the cape. Similarly, we don't allow anybody to bring whole carcasses in. If you go out and hunt in Wyoming and Nebraska, you know, any of the other 23 other states that have chronic wasting disease, legally you cannot bring back that carcass. All you can bring back is the boned out meat, the skull cap, and the cape.
You didn't mention Wisconsin.
Well, Wisconsin's there, and there's 24 states in the nation that have chronic
wasting disease. And Canada.
And three provinces in Canada. Oh. Now the disease has spread to Norway. They've got it in moose and reindeer deer in Norway, and it's spread from Saskatchewan, Canada, to South Korea in an elk herd.
Because I think what we're going to push is, rather than, you know, say 23 states, we don't bring deer from out of state into Michigan without treating them properly, because, you know, you can't sit there and, like, roll the dice on, well, am I in state 24 that doesn't have it yet? And they could, like Terry, I just reviewed it, very well could be there. They just haven't found it yet. So I think one of our recommendations is going to be to, you know, if it comes from anywhere but the UP, bone it, you know, and treat it like it has it. And that's part of our prevention message.
Yeah, and so, this is what started after the detection a couple of years ago that Terry mentioned in Wisconsin, within 30 miles of the border. We started the Keep the UP CWD Free campaign, and that was an education and outreach campaign to hunters and try to get more awareness of the disease. And one of the main focuses was this idea of, when you hunt out west or out of state, don't bring animals back to Michigan. And some of the efforts we undertook were to, for 2 years now, we've been putting up billboards along the Michigan-Wisconsin borders, telling hunters, if you're going out of state, you know the rules and know what's happening. And there's also been, we've done interviews and we've produced some fact sheets and done some television and newspaper articles, with just trying to get the word out with hunters to have them more aware of this.
Oh, go ahead, Terry.
Well, what I want to do, I want to come back to something you just said, JR, and that is, you know, don't bring any carcasses back. 2 years ago, they didn't know that they had it in Arkansas. They found their first diseased deer 2 years ago in Arkansas. Now that they're testing, 30% of their herd is infected. So be vigilant. Be, you know, pay attention to what the hell you're doing out there.
Because another one of the things we're looking at and we talked about is even bringing deer from downstate back up to the UP. And that's one of the things that, you know, we had talked about, you know, where your biggest bang for the buck is. And people talk about, you know the year ends and the you know, different things people use to draw in animals when you're hunting. And, you know, even sugar beets from downstate and all that. And basically what the biology says in the state veterinarian, Kelly Straka, is that that's kind of unlikely, but he says, probably the way it's going to come into the UP is either through a cervid or through a carcass, right, Terry?
Right, right. You know, and you look, because it can be incorporated into grasses, people are buying second-cut alfalfa from central or southern Wisconsin. We know that it can be spread that way. So you want to be careful where you're bringing all your food items from if you're baiting and feeding. Ultimately, we need to take a look at how we're operating as hunters out there, not only in terms of bringing animals in, but also in terms of the methods that we're using. And are we facilitating the spread? If we don't know it's there, are we going to facilitate the spread?
Because we talk about prevention, and I'll go and talk to a lot of my friends, and, you know, most of the Upers are hunters, and most of them would have no idea about the carcass regulations, I would say. Well, I would say a lot of them wouldn't know, and it's a part of why it's nice to have us on today, is that we can spread that message. And it's sort of like why we created the task force, the UP CWD task forces, to get the stakeholders involved and get them to get the message out, you know, and I think they've done a heck of a good job at it. And I mean, our goal in life is to look at the rules and regulations as they sit now, see if we can live with what's going to happen, because I think Terry can go through what will happen if they do find CWD in the UP and what the current rules say. And if we're comfortable with what and how they read and we can live with that, then we're going to continue to spread the message. And if we want to make recommendations on baiting and feeding, because it's obviously, when you live, you had talked about earlier, you know, the different things that are against the deer. It's almost like the perfect storm in the UP. You know, when they do a predator prey study, and they say in the mid snowfall zone that no fawns survived in the second year of that ice snowfall. I mean, you're losing generations of deer anyway, and all of a sudden you have less cutting because there's, you know, there's just less of that going on up here. You have less habitat. You have predators, you know, anything, coyotes, the wolves, the bobcats, the bears. And the next thing you know, here you go, you got a CWD virus going around, and you're going like, you know, what's the positives for these deer? And what we have to do is make sure that we can take the things we can control, which is spreading CWD and habitat. And that's two of the biggest things that we're working on.
Copper Country Today will be right back.